the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to ExchangeWire's MadTech Podcast, our weekly dive into the worlds of media, marketing and e-commerce. I'm John Still, Head of Content at ExchangeWire, and it's been a big week for us. A few of our team are just back from our ATS Singapore conference. It was a great event, lots of excellent speakers. Do keep your eyes on ExchangeWire over the next few days for all the highlights. Joining me on the podcast today in overcoming the last of our jet lag is my colleague, ExchangeWire's COO, Lindsay Rowntree. Lindsay, how are you today?
Tired.
Yeah, snap.
I feel like I will forever be tired, and I can't ever see a way around being tired. So I'm assuming it'll get better, and I'll stop waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning. But at the moment, that's what's happening. We'll get there. But it was all worth it. ATS Singapore was amazing, so I can't complain.
Good. Well, thank you very much for powering through and joining us this morning. Looking forward. We're going to have a great chat. We're absolutely delighted to be joined today by our special guest, Chiesa Lamour, the Global Head of Media for Wunderman Thompson Commerce. Welcome, Chiesa. Thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me. Listen, I am flustered because IT decided to come at me this morning when I didn't send for it. So this will be fun.
Excellent. Well, it's good to know that we are all on absolute top form this morning and all ready for an in-depth conversation about the future of e-commerce. Cool. Well, we've got some really interesting stories to dive into. Let's head straight into the first one, which is retail media, the rise and rise of retail media and the growth that it's looking for over the next few months. Global retail media spend could rise 15% year over year to $101 billion in 2022 and again to $160 billion by 2027, according to GroupM's 2022 e-commerce and retail media forecast. This growth will largely be spurred by the big players, Alibaba, Amazon, and Walmart, but the space is set to become more competitive as more brands enter retail media. GroupM's Global Director of Business Intelligence, Kate Scott-Dawkins, described the estimated growth rate of retail media by 60% over the next 5 years as a bit on the conservative side, but nonetheless puts retail media's growth ahead of digital advertising. Chiesa, do you think this is a realistic prediction? And what do you think is driving this growth in retail media?
I would say that, you know, it is a realistic prediction from a direction of travel point of view. But also at the same time, as Kate said herself, it is a conservative one, you know, certainly from a value or volume point of view. Especially when you look at some of the predictions that were made by Boston Consulting Group or McKinsey this year, whereby, you know, if you put that in context of the BCG forecast, they estimate that in the US alone, the retail media market will grow 25% annually to reach $100 billion over the next 4 years, and will account for over, I think, 25% of total digital media spending by 2026, right? So if the US alone is going to generate $100 billion by 2026, then certainly the global numbers that have been pushed by GroupM are conservative. And McKinsey as well, right, released, you know, similar prediction over the summer. And they even went as far as looking at the full value chain of retail media and estimating it to reach $1.3 trillion value by 2026. So, you know, some big numbers there. In terms of the growth part of your question, I think it's really is a combination of elements, right, which are going to provide, I guess, the perfect storm for that growth. I like to think of it in different or separate buckets. So if you look at it, first of all, from a data aspect point of view, right, we have the push towards privacy compliant data and standards from both a regulatory, you know, standpoint, certainly, you know, GDPR was the onset of that and the CCPA, but also, you know, tech companies themselves and the decisions that are being made by Apple and Google. So we have that departure from the third-party cookie-reliant digital world, which affects, you know, targeting, personalization, frequency capping, measurement. So we have a conundrum where we live in a data-driven everything world, but have less and less data opportunity to do the driving. And therefore, right, those with deep first-party data would win, and retailers certainly are sitting in the front row of that. The second element, you know, from a data aspect is really the ability for retailers to offer, you know, closed loop measurement on actual purchase data, i.e. who bought what in response to which ad. And that is a very attractive promise for marketers who are, I guess, you know, increasingly under pressure to demonstrate, you know, return on every ad dollar. But also retailers are basically sitting on data and insight that can help inform, you know, product development, product innovation, new market positioning, etc. But then there is a second element to that is the business opportunity aspect, whereby retail media offers higher margins than trade and retail margins, and probably, you know, is less capital intensive as well. So that in itself is a very, I would say, lucrative proposition, right, to retailers as an additional revenue stream and a strong, you know, incentive to invest in that. Again, if you go back to some of the studies released by BCG and McKinsey, you know, yes, in the US context, but I think, you know, it could apply to other markets in Europe in particular, right? By BCG's estimate, the retail media market will yield margins between 70 and 90%. And McKinsey's estimates are a bit more conservative, but it's still between 50 and 70%, right? So we are talking 30 to 70 percentage points on average compared to retail margin. So, you know, through retail media, what that means that through retail media alone, right, as a retailer, you can almost subsidize other parts of your business. And then the last element, I think, that is going to drive the growth is really what I like to define as the shifts in market. And there are a few shifts in market. The first one, I think, is the opportunities that retailers themselves, we start offering brands from both an inventory point of view, i.e. giving access to more than just, you know, search ads, which were the onset of retail media, you know, that really bottom funnel approach, to then also offering an ad offering that will include more upper funnel awareness driving formats and channels. And also, I think the crux of the matter, you know, data access beyond their own and operated properties, right? We can see what Walmart and Tesco and Sainsbury's are doing, enabling marketers to activate in programmatic and paid social environment, but also beyond what I think will come and maybe is not happening right now, but will certainly, you know, come, is offering that data access to suppliers beyond the endemic suppliers, i.e. the brands that sell products through those retailers. And I think all of that will contribute to that growth. I don't think generally that it is a stretch of the imagination to think, for example, that a Tesco could make its data available to an automotive brand, or that an Argos could make, you know, its data available to a content insurance company. And then there's also the new entrants into the market, even though, you know, more from a niche and marginal point of view in terms of percentage growth, that are going to contribute to that growth, because it's just, you know, more opportunities and more options for marketers to tap into. You know, there's a lot of talks around, you know, consumer electronics, health and beauty, DIY, automotive, because, you know, those brands as well have a high level of customer interaction and therefore, you know, rich first party data. And then, of course, you know, the last point that I would like to make here is that the fact that marketers have been used to programmatic is also going to be one element that will drive growth. Why? Because brands are used to having now a certain level of control and transparency, or transparency-ish, right? So they are starting to push back against the traditional ways of advertising and promoting with retailers, which means that as a retailer, if you want to continue seeing those ad dollars that you're seeing in trade, you will need to adapt, or you're losing out to the competition. But, you know, I'll just finish here because I'm realizing that I've been talking. I'm just passionate about the subject. But I'd like to say that, you know, despite all of that growth that everybody's talking about, this doesn't come without its challenges, right? You don't just wake up one day and boom, you are a retail media network. It requires investment in data infrastructures. It requires investment in technology, new skill sets, ways of working, people, new commercial model, but also ensuring that in the shift of moving from just being a retailer to, you know, becoming an advertising powerhouse, retailers will also need to rethink how they protect customers' experiences, especially, you know, on their website, and that is also going to be a key element to think about. And I will shut up.
Definitely don't shut up. This is all incredible, insightful stuff, and you know, a really interesting take on the retail media landscape. Lindsay, retail media is, you know, it's one of ExchangeWire's pillars for this year. It's something that we've talked about frequently at our events and on our sites. Do you see this estimate as conservative? Do you think this is realistic? And, you know, Chiesa mentioned the shift from being retailers into media networks. How have you seen that come about in recent times?
I mean, after everything Chiesa just said there, I've got nothing to add because she has covered everything. No surprise, given that she is an expert in this area, but I will add no value here whatsoever. I agree with Chiesa based on what I know of retail media, which is not nowhere near as much. It does feel conservative. And I think, you know, GroupM themselves said it was potentially on the conservative side. And a lot of the value placed against it was based on the knowledge or kind of assumptions, if you like, of Amazon's value of retail media. Amazon being obviously the largest e-commerce platform, certainly, well globally, but certainly in this part of the world. And I think that if you're basing it on that, you almost know already that it's going to end up being more. But I think that what fascinates me, and obviously Chiesa has mentioned a lot of this stuff already, is where the growth will come from. And, you know, we had a chat on stage at ATIS Singapore last week about retail media, and we had Chiesa, your APAC colleague Justin Payton on stage talking about retail media, and we had JJ Eastwood from Carousel, which, for those that don't know what Carousel is, it's a marketplace that out in the APAC region. You know, talking about the growth of retail media, and one thing that, to Chiesa's point about the growth from endemic brands to non-endemic brands and the opportunities there, an anecdote that JJ provided of Carousel I thought was really fascinating, which was an incoming brief from them, a retail media brief from an insurance company that wanted leads. He said, like, previously, we'd have hidden under the table whenever someone like an insurance company would come to us saying, we want leads through you as a retail media network. What do we do with that? But actually, they thought about it and they went and looked at the top three search terms on Carousel's site over that time period, which were, I think it was something like a Nintendo Wii, an iPhone, and something else tech-focused. And they, so that using their own first-party data and their own knowledge of their platform, they went to the insurance company and they said, right, these are top three search terms. Put these as a free offer in your banner ads on our site and you will get traction. And the insurance company got loads of leads. And that, for me, was a really interesting way of how a non-endemic brand can take advantage of retail media and not just plant a random, generic, irrelevant ad on a retail media network and think it's going to work. And that, I think, that's the exciting part. And I think that what's interesting about the stats around retail media is what I'd be fascinated to know is kind of what that looks like from a region by region basis. Because, you know, for example, in APAC, sorry to keep going on about APAC, but it's fresh in my mind. It's not as big over there as it is in certainly in the US. It's not quite as big in Europe as it is in the US. And there's a lot more that can be done. And I think that it's still assumed that, you know, CPG is the bread and butter of retail media, and that's where most of the opportunity lies. But Chiesa, as you already pointed out, there's so much opportunity in luxury, in consumer electronics, in home and garden, in footwear and apparel. There's so much opportunity there. And I think that that's where, outside of CPG, there's so much that can be done. And, you know, from a few other chats with people kind of out in market in Southeast Asia, there's opportunity galore from a kind of a commerce-led region. It is so commerce-led. Retail media networks can really, really thrive here. And there's so much more opportunity outside of the likes of Amazon and Alibaba, which is what probably people think is where it stems from. But tech needs to approach it, any kind of tech going into the, like, going into working retail media networks, from DSPs and everything else, will need to not adopt a cookie cutter approach when entering new markets. So they can't. So they there are some tech platforms, some big DSPs that have got some great partnerships with US retailers like Kroger, like Walmart. They probably can't apply that exact same model to the European market because the European market consists of many, many different countries that all operate very, very differently. And then Southeast Asia, even more so. You know, Southeast Asia, you've still got certain markets. You will still transport your inventory via a little canal boat to little islands, and the majority of the inventory is mom and pop shops. It's not giant retailers like they'd have you believe. And so can DSPs approach to retail media and retail media networks in the US be applied to Asia? no, it probably can't. So how do we make sure that we can really, really accelerate that growth in other regions as well, but using appropriate technology and appropriate nuances that will apply to those different regions as well? Rant over.
I think the interesting point on that, and it was also in the report, is the growth of the independent networks who are going to be taking on the players like Alibaba, like Amazon, like Walmart. In your experience, Kiese, is there going to be room? Is this something that will develop over the next few years?
I think there's going to be room, right? But I also fundamentally believe that you will have, as much as I hate the term, dominant players, and then you will have, you know, the players that are going to be lagging. But I think because retail itself is such a vast sector with so many, you know, subsectors, I think you're going to have, you know, some retailers that operate across the board that are more like generalist mass market, but there's going to be opportunity for niche players that play within, you know, specific sectors, be it health and beauty, be it consumer electronic, be it, you know, travel, hotels, or, you know, which section of the travel industry. And I think that because it is still nascent, right? When I think about retail media today, I place myself, right, 12 years ago or 13 years ago when I started in programmatic, and hopefully that doesn't betray my age. and, you know, so there's still room for growth. There's still, you know, room for new players and new entrants to come and disrupt the whole thing or take a portion of the pie. So, you know, if you have retailers today that feel like, oh, you know, I didn't go into this, I'm already late. No, you aren't, because this actually started taking off in the US 2 years ago and in the UK, you know, properly last year, right? So if you look at the decision that Tesco, Sainsbury's, Argos made, all of that started crystallizing only last year. So there is space, you know, and there's still time to go into it, but you need to be prepared about the sacrifices or the investment that you will need to do as a retailer to be able to deliver value for clients, because we are operating in a, you know, programmatic world. We are operating in a digitally transformed world. So old ways of working are not going to cut it here.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like you say, a huge area of opportunity, and definitely one that people should not be dismissing as if they've come too late, because it's growing all the time, and definitely one of the hot topics to watch over the next couple of years. I think we've completed retail media with that, so...
That was quick.
You can never complete retail media.
No, exactly. Until next time.
Don't dismiss it.
Well, on to our second story of the week. And it's something that's, you know, it's been bubbling over for a while in terms of the regulation of big tech. And the news this week is that the European Commission chief has pointed to new laws and collaboration as being key to tackling big tech. The European Commission's chief competitions officer, Margarita Vestager, has reasserted her office's mission to rein in the dominance of big tech. Speaking to Wired, Vestager said that the Commission has been working more closely with authorities in the US, where leading players like Google and Meta are based, to ensure that instances of anti-competitive behaviour are remedied. Speaking about the upcoming Digital Services Act and Digital Markets Act, Vestager asserted that the DSA will provide internet users with consumer rights that are more similar to those than they have offline, while the DMA will give smaller companies a better chance of thriving by more closely monitoring the activities of dominant firms, including proposed acquisitions. Marguerite Vestager has form in taking on the tech giants. She's fined Apple for tax avoidance in Ireland. She's taken on Google over anti-competitive behaviour previously. And her main message is that Europe is open for business, but there are rules. Lindsay, do you think further collaboration between the states and the EU could really pay off? Will we see more kind of concrete action against big firms disobeying the rules?
I think that Margaret Vestager, obviously an absolute powerhouse of a woman in terms of what she's done to take on big tech, I think she's absolutely right in her aspersions that this is a global issue. This shouldn't and can't really, you know, in the long term, be tackled on a market by market basis. markets are certainly trying. And so the EU, Margaret's done loads. Obviously, individually within the EU, Spain have taken action, France have taken action, the UK, no longer part of the EU, of course, have taken action. The US, we know, have taken action. Australia, Korea, you know, there's loads of different countries that are trying to come against big tech and try to kind of rein them in a bit. And I think that the fact that it's, you know, it's obvious, these are global companies. They operate globally. They don't really, unless they really, really have different rules in the different markets they operate. So they should be made to. They're like, as a result of them being a global operation, they need to be approached from a global perspective. We do need to collaborate. Now, that historically isn't the easiest thing to do. And of course, each country has its own rules and regulations around what big tech can do and around data privacy and consumer rights. But there is common ground amongst many of these. That basically we're trying to protect the rights of our consumers, protect the rights of the smaller players in the industry as well, and not allow big dominant players to completely take over and believe that they are bigger than any one government entity. And that, I think, is where collaboration really, really is key. And, you know, if you look at the approaches everyone's taken is very, very different. So Korea's approach was related to the App Store. France's latest attack on Google was down to that kind of preloaded apps. The UK have done it with data privacy. The US, obviously, pick a lane, any lane. They've gone down most of them to try to get to rein in big tech. But actually, we've all got similar challenges with them. And it's just kind of what sticks for each different market. If we work together, you might find a lot more sticks and we can get a lot more traction. Not that that will be remotely easy, but I think it is something that needs to be explored, because if they can operate globally, why can't we do something similar as regulators, if you like?
Yeah. Kiese, what do you think on that?
What was the question again? I was so embroiled and fascinated by what Lisa was saying that I completely forgot.
Well, of course you were.
Hit me up again. Sorry.
No worries. So, how do you see collaboration between the states and the EU really paying off in the long term?
Ah, right. Yes. I almost answered in French.
that works too.
I humbly think that it is difficult to answer this question fairly and appropriately without looking at the geopolitical backdrop that has hindered, you know, previous EU-US attempts at collaborating, and why this collaboration is likely to succeed better now than it has ever before. If you look at, for example, the world of the Obama administration, right, then the 4 years that succeeded that, it is completely different from Biden's, right? And don't forget that Biden was also part of the Obama administration. He was his VP. But Obama was pro-US tech. And the what I like to call the defunct TIPP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, I think that's what it stands for, that his administration tried to implement, was broadly more about, you know, trade relations than consumer protection. But then, right, enters 4 years of a Trump presidency, and all of a sudden, we were seeing an other side of how tech platforms can be used to disrupt our democracies, right? Enters Cambridge Analytica, which showed just how powerful the use of data can be to manipulate the political debate. Entered, you know, Russia's influence and meddling in financing and conducting mass misinformation campaigns, which really threatened the political debate in the US and the UK in particular with Brexit. And then entered a lot more convocation at Capitol Hill of the tech firms, even though, you know, they've become popular memes on the internet. Senator, no, we don't. WhatsApp is encrypted. Anyway, let's move on. But also, there's also have been, you know, post the Obama era, the rise of TikTok, the rise of, you know, Alibaba, meaning that the US is almost no longer the sole originator of big tech. So there's a power shift almost, which requires and kind of forces the US and EU alliance to work. So when you look at all of that, you can see that it has contributed definitely, I mean, that's my personal opinion, to President Biden's administration be more committed to revitalizing, first of all, the transatlantic relationship that had been, you know, impacted during the Trump era, and really intensifying, you know, scrutiny of the technology industry. And him himself, within, I think, his 6 months of power, said that. And then you have a few elements also that are showing, you know, there's going to be a shift and why this is more likely to work. You have the US-EU Trade and Technology Council that was launched last year. You have Biden's appointing a big tech critic in Lina Khan at the Federal Trade Commission. You have the EU setting up office in the Silicon Valley to be closer to tech companies and have a more collaborative approach and not, you know, regulations from Brussels. And these are just few indications that this collaboration could pay off, provided, of course, that, you know, whoever becomes, you know, president in the United States for after Biden, or if Biden is renewed, continues with that agenda. Then I think you asked me a second question, right?
That was the one for now. I was about to go on to a second one.
Okay, brilliant.
Yeah, no, it's you make a really interesting point, I think, there in terms of, you know, how the political landscape has changed and the attitude to big tech being, you know, the power being flexed over the last few years, and how governments have come to see it as you know, something of immense power and something that really does need to be looked at. And that's an interesting point as to why this collaboration is so necessary now. I think one of the interesting points in the Marguerite Vestager interview that she made was that she is disappointed that more businesses aren't out there doing privacy by default, but she also believes that consumers aren't aware enough of their own rights and their own data rights, and that they actually have rights over what is collected and what they hand over. So the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act that are coming up, Lindsay, do you think that they will help kind of balance this out, let consumers know what they are in charge of in terms of their own personal data?
I hope so. I think that it's very, very challenging to educate consumers when we're almost this far down the line, to bring it back to AIPAC again, just because, again, you know, I was there so recently and that's all I can talk about now. talking to brands and publishers over in the region, certainly in Southeast Asia, where regulation is not quite the same. There's not much regulation. No, it's up and coming, but there's not as that, you know, you could do at the moment, you can do relatively what you like with data versus what you can do over in Europe and the US. But the interesting thing is there is a lot more privacy focused there are a lot more focused conversations happening between brands and publishers. Now, it's always been the way that in Asia, certainly, the value exchange is better understood. In Asia, they've always understood, if I give you my data, I will get this service for free. And that helps, definitely. It's something that's not understood in this part of the world as easily at all, which makes it challenging. It makes it challenging to educate, because you stop, you know, someone says they don't want their data, and you say, well, you're not having this then. They go, well, why? And that's always been a challenge, something that, you know, the government are trying to stop and trying to ensure that we can give people things for free without requiring stuff off the back of them being part of just a normal service. But it does make education around consumer data rights much more complicated. Whereas over in Asia, they're starting to focus on privacy by design, starting to focus on how they can communicate with their consumers better and explain to them exactly what their rights are. And they're doing it because they want to, not because they have to or are being forced to by any particular regulation. And that's what makes it interesting. So I think one of the things that Margaret Vestager was saying, as you pointed out, John, is that these companies are doing so because they're being told to, and because they're being told to, they aren't doing it based on logic or based on what they want. If they were consumers themselves, what would they want to experience when they go on to enter a website? They're doing it based on a rule they've been told. So it's being done on autopilot rather than, well, actually, if I were using this site, what would I want to experience? And that is the case across so many different sites. Pick a site, any site. How annoying are these pop-ups? How annoying is the way they communicate with you as to whether you can, what you can or can't do, how you can say yes or no to cookies? It's so frustrating. What seems to be the conversation in Asia is that we're much more aware of what rights are, we're much more aware of what the value exchange is, and because we aren't being forced to do so by any particular government or any particular regulation, we can play around with what works and what gives our consumers the best experience still, while helping them understand what their rights are. that's where we need to get to. It's not just about educating consumers. It's about educating site owners, about educating tech companies. And that, I think, is the missing link still, because everyone kind of goes, well, it's not my job to educate consumers. It's their job. Well, surely the consumer should already know. And I think that's where everyone is passing the buck to somebody else. That just means we're not getting anywhere. And that means these pop-ups, these incessant pop-ups, just keep driving us up the wall, and we're not actually moving the needle.
Yeah.
Lindy, yeah. President, I am.
Yes.
We're developing a manifesto today, guys. This is excellent.
We are.
Kiese, how do you feel about that? You were nodding along, so I assume some agreement with what Lindsay was saying there.
I mean, I completely agree with everything that Lindsay said. You know, there's no debate about that. But because I, you know, also experienced DGPR and how, I don't know, I don't want to use a bad word on a podcast, but how just shit it was in its implementation across Europe, I'm kind of a little bit more, you know, positive and in my honeymoon, you know, flower girl period when it comes to the DMA and the DSA, because I think that, you know, the DMA legislation provides an alternative to the traditional antitrust, you're too big, American company, split it approach, and really potentially avoid, you know, courts and large lawsuits by really giving clear-ish set of standards, certainly clearer than what we used to see with previous EU regulations. Why is the DSA really, you know, gives greater transparency and potentially better access to data? All good things, right? And I think, quite honestly, the attempt by the DSA to also harmonize, right, different national laws across the European Union when it comes to, you know, illegal content is a good thing. The provision to ban, you know, dark patterns is a good thing. Or, you know, proposing independent auditing so that nobody is making or marking their own homework, all of that good ideas in principle. Likewise, you know, for on the DMA side, provision against things like, you know, self-referencing, or even, you know, potentially fielding small, you know, smaller companies against, you know, big tech acquisitions, all good ideas in principle. However, I also see a few pitfalls, right? If you look at GDPR, especially, which is the most recent example, oftentimes these propositions are predominantly made by regulators. So people that understand the rule of law, but not often understand tech. So the risk, therefore, is that we end up with regulations that are potentially not easy to apply or difficult to enforce. So there is also always the danger of how these are going to be implemented, you know, like Lindsay mentioned, across each EU member state. And if GDPR is something to go by, we can see that there was various degrees of implementation and enforcement across the bloc, right, with Germany, France, and the Netherlands taking a harder stance than, for example, other countries in the EU, which the UK used to be a part of. Another potential challenge that I see is that, can the EU actually pull it off? This is going to require hiring new talent. And by the looks of it, you know, they will need people that would traditionally be hired by the GAFAM, right? And from a financial and logistical point of view, right, how are they going to monitor, audit, enforce? And if you've read some of the articles the past few months, the numbers that is being floated in the corridors of powers is that this is going to cost, I think, more than 25 million euros a year, right, to finance the monitoring, auditing, and enforcement of these regulations. And then potentially, I think, you know, because I'm a big fan of technology in general, not necessarily tech companies, but technology in general, what I potentially see is one of the most critical challenge that the EU are going to face is what guarantees, right, is the EU ready to give tech companies to protect their data, their information, you know, from making their appearance or being leaked, exposed, right, publicly? Because I'm thinking particularly about the obligation, I think, within the DSA to disclose how companies' algorithms work. Good idea in principle, but this also poses the risk to tech companies too, because it's like asking KFC to disclose its secret sauce. So I think there's going to be a lot of conversations to be had there and find a model that works for consumers, that works for, you know, business practices and competition practices, but also work for the tech companies as well.
100% agree with that. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's I mean, I love the special sauce analogy for revealing the algorithms. I think that's incredibly interesting and a really interesting take on that. It will be very interesting to see what becomes of these the DSA and DMA, and we hope that this collaboration is not more grandstanding, that it actually has an impact going forward. We will keep an eye on it. Speaking of stuff that we really need to keep an eye on, the next story, we will look at the ad industry and its impact on the environment. Over 75% of marketers believe that the ad industry is not doing enough to reduce its carbon footprint. Research by Goodloop found that 87% of marketers also think the industry has a responsibility to lower emissions. The Counting Carbon, How US Marketers Are Tackling Adland's Climate Crisis study revealed a lack of standardization when it comes to calculating the environmental impact of campaigns, with 56% of US marketers relying on estimated figures. The study also indicates a sluggishness to act amongst marketers themselves, with just 2% of surveyed organizations having reached net zero, and only 24% having set targets to achieve this goal, despite 51% saying they plan to do so at some stage. Chiesa, do you think that the industry is, do you agree that the industry isn't doing enough? And why do you think this is the case?
I would tend to agree with the 75% that say the industry isn't doing enough and it needs to be doing more. But also, when you see that only 24% have set targets, right, it's very difficult to argue otherwise. But again, I think I like buts, right? Yes, but it's very French, you know. But I don't think it is out of spite for the planet or out of, you know, not loving the planet or not you know, seeing how urgent the need to make change is. I think, you know, it's just out of sheer confusion, right? About understanding what we are actually dealing with, about understanding how to measure our carbon footprint, about understanding how to tackle it, right? If you just go on Google and try to type in measure carbon footprint, you will see a florilège of information and methodologies that don't even align with one another. So it's very difficult to try and sort out, you know, what is it and what isn't. But I think we need, you know, education definitely is key, right? But we need to educate the industry beyond just, you know, the colorful recycled bins that we all have in our offices, right? And really offer practical, tangible tweaks in behavior that we can start implementing even in our day-to-day to decarbonize. It's not just about, you know, the big element of, you know, the carbon emission generated by the ad activity, or, you know, the itself, but certainly, you know, looking at also how we behave as an industry on a day-to-day. So yes, looking at the production and distribution and proliferation of ads, but also, you know, on a day-to-day, what can we do as, you know, employees to our respective corporation? So and I believe, you know, one doesn't exclude the other. They can work in tandem, because oftentimes as well, you know, people feel overwhelmed because it seems like, oh, it always has to be big stuff that we have to start doing. And people freeze. They don't even know where to start. They don't even know where to start even in investment. I'll give you a few examples of, you know, things from a day-to-day point of view. So there's always talks about, you know, video streaming, you know, producing a lot of emission. So yes, you know, things like, when you are a marketer and you have to deploy campaigns, do you actually need a video campaign as part of that marketing mix for that specific launch? Maybe not, right? So we have to become more intentional in the decisions that we make in terms of our marketing mix. If you need video, does it need to be 3 minutes? Maybe it can be 2 minutes, right? Because the file, video size, and video length, they add a lot of pressure on the servers. Processing data at low peak times, maybe we can do that. You don't need to run, you know, your data processing 4 times a day. Maybe you can do that maybe at 1 a.m. That can have a different impact. But even on a day-to-day as employees, did you know that emptying your email box regularly, you know, to reduce data storage can have a positive impact? Sending less emails can have a positive impact. Avoiding the reply all, for example, can have a positive impact. I was able to plug one data point from Capgemini that really just, you know, opened my eyes to that and, you know, helped me to be more thoughtful about how many emails I send per day and if I actually need to send email. Capgemini found that if everybody that has access to email sent one less email per day, we could reduce emissions by 16,433 tons of CO2, which is the equivalent of 81,152 flights from London to Madrid, right? So when you start thinking of things that are like, oh, right, okay, we can do more as corporations. But also, oftentimes, the default solution, right, is to offset. And it's a step in the right direction, but I personally don't like offsetting because it feels like, you know, throwing money at a problem whilst continuing to comfortably pollute instead of driving fundamental behavioral change. And yes, I appreciate that, you know, it takes more time for people to change their behaviors. It's harder to achieve. But again, you know, like I've said, starting implementing those small tweaks on a day-to-day do make a difference. Another element that we could also look at is our device usage within the industry, right? We are a device-heavy industry. Some of us work with 2, 3, 4 screens, and then we have, you know, phones that are supplied by our companies. How do we dispose of those devices, you know, after their lifespan? Or even, do we even use them long enough? How often do we renew our, you know, technological part, as we would say, you know, in France? So all of these elements, I think, put together need to be part of that education. And it shouldn't always be about, you know, those big conversations that happen, you know, at the World Economic Forum, right? It needs to start with the way we work day to day and also the decisions that we make for our marketing strategies. And I'll shut up again.
Not at all. I think that's fascinating, actually. It's we so often this stuff is wrapped up with the bigger picture. And whether companies are, you know, doing the major things that make the headlines, whether they are, you know, they are living their values, so to speak. And what's not discussed a lot is what you've talked about, which is the very small day-to-day changes and the whole education piece around net zero and about carbon reduction. We had an ESG panel at ATS Singapore, which I was moderating, and threw up some very interesting points similar along to what you were saying in terms of our own industry ads and our own creative. And how, considering the length of your video, considering how you host things on your site, all of that has a much larger impact than some of the, you know, some planting a tree for every beer you sell or something like that. It's, you know, it's very, it's the fundamentals are very, very important here. Lindsay, how do you see the industry in terms of carbon footprint, in terms of climate change? And do you think that we're doing enough?
No, we're doing nowhere near enough. You know, KSA threw up some fascinating stats there. The Capgemini stat about like one less email per person per day is terrifying and fascinating all at once. But it also throws up how many data points there are around ESG at the moment, how many data points there are around carbon emissions that make me go, wait, how many carbon tons did she say? And how many flights to Madrid was that? Was it London to Madrid or was it London to Berlin? And there's so many of these different stats around that you kind of go, whoa, that's fascinating and amazing. But then you forget about it because another one comes along and you go, if I were to do this one less per day, that would mean that I'd be flying the equivalent to New York 10 times back. And I can't keep up with all the different reference points because there are too many of them, but they are fascinating and we need to contextualise it. They absolutely need context, otherwise it's just meaningless. These however many thousand tons of CO2 means nothing to your average person. It means nothing to me. The contextualisation is very, very important, and often it's contextualised using flights. I remember years ago, there was, and I'm talking probably 15 years ago, there was a stat that came out that said for every Google search you make, it's the equivalent of boiling, or every two Google searches, it's the equivalent of boiling a kettle. I've just actually had to go and verify that, because actually it turns out it was kind of debunked, and it turned out that that fact was never kind of completely said. Not to say that a Google search wouldn't be carbon intensive, because obviously it would be. Think about the time on screen for the person. Think about the servers required to kind of make a search in less than a second, and how many results are pulled up. If you think about that as one Google search, and there are billions upon billions of them a day. And, you know, we had 50, the tech company in their office yesterday doing some recording with us, talking about ESG. They're going after their B Corp certification. And the offsetting comment that you made, Kirsa, is very, very interesting, because I agree too much focus is put on offsetting rather than just being net zero. But again, there's education around, you know, people think offsetting is the future. But actually, planting trees is not going to... Only one in 10 trees planted actually takes. And for a tree to grow properly, it requires 2 full watering cans of water per day. Well, if you're planting trees in drought-ridden places, you know, that includes the UK for the past couple of months, then these trees are not going to grow that everyone thinks they're planting and saving the world. For every toilet roll I buy, like, Andrex will plant 2 trees for me. What if those 2 trees don't take? Then I've just used up more resources and not replace anything. And there's so much stuff around that. But Kirsa, to your point about emails as well, like, I think there was a stat that we had on stage at ATS London, again, on the ESG panel. I forget who said it, but it was, not, you know, send fewer emails, definitely. But also send text-based emails. For every email with an image in it, I mean, how many emails do you get a day that have got flashing images in them as their signatures? No need. How many emissions are they using versus a text-based email? How much spam am I getting that has random pictures of cats in it? Like, stop sending me these ridiculous emails. Honestly, it's just wasteful. And it made me think as well about, you know, the what you were saying about when it comes to campaign planning and execution. Do you need to have a video campaign as part of this? Does it need to be 3 minutes long? Can it be 6 seconds long? Also, you know, viewability only came into play in the past few years. Before that... The majority of ads that were actually being produced weren't even being seen. And that's still the case today, but at least more are being seen than used to be. We're producing all these ads, publishing them on web pages, most of them were moving images, and they were not being seen by humans. I mean, how unbelievably wasteful is that? And if that's our starting point, then, you know, that we have improved. But I think the concern we have is many people probably think digital advertising is green because... it doesn't involve any kind of, like, you can't physically see carbon emissions. You can't physically see paper being used. But it's no, like, your average consumer does not understand how using a laptop and searching on the internet and doing a video call, how intensive that is. And therein lies the problem in many cases. But also, when I first read the intro to this, John, like, over 75% of marketers believe the ad industry is not doing enough to reduce carbon footprint. What role do the marketers play in this as well? Because obviously many of these big brands, they have their own carbon emissions goals. They have their own broader ESG goals when it comes to...
Well, only 24%. Only 24%,
Lindsay. Exactly. There you go.
don't pat them on the back.
I know. And that's exactly it. Like, they're saying, oh, you need to... Like, again, where does the buck sit? Right? Who takes responsibility? Do the marketers? Do the tech industry? Do the consumers? Everyone thinks, well, I didn't create this, so it isn't my job to fix it. And that... again, becomes a massive, massive problem. And actually, you know, from a marketer perspective, should marketing teams within brands be given ESG targets as part of their forecast, as part of their goals? So absolutely. When they go to their tech partners, to their agencies, an ESG goal, an emissions goal is baked in. So let's not do the video campaign because we don't need video and we're trying to reduce our carbon emissions as a giant brand. That will help you, agency, do your job better, which will help tech partner do their job better, and means we can all collectively become more, like, hopefully get to net zero. Long way to go, but that was even more of a rant than yours, Kirsa, and that was at least your rant had stats in it, mine did not.
I think we're all high on adrenaline this morning.
I think so.
you feel, you know, potentially jet lagged, and, you know, I have my IT beef.
it's all being taken out on the ad industry today, and I'm loving it. Kirsa, Lindsay made a couple of really interesting points there about, I think, standards is a really big one. I think standardization is something that the industry needs to look at, and I wonder if what you think about the possibilities for that, and also in the short term whether companies will be willing to sacrifice the bottom line, whether that's something that's, you know, it was mentioned on the panel that it's something has to give basically for them to make these considerations. Do you see that as something remotely possible?
Are you seriously asking me that question in a week when the pound has dropped, in a week where we're talking about scaring headlines of deep recessions, in a context where inflation is going up? You're asking me if companies are going to prioritize.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
question
it.
Question asked and answered.
Yeah.
Do you know? So that's your answer, and that's my answer, and I stand by it.
Yeah, I
think at a human level, right, if I'm a marketer, if I'm an ad person, yes, at a human level and personal level, I think everybody thinks this is important and everybody has the willingness to invest. But because of all these big, big, big headlines that I've just spoken about that are going to put even more pressure on the bottom line, the reality is that it's unlikely people are going to sacrifice, you know, the bottom line to invest into this. Even though, like President Macron said, there is no planet B, the reality, like, you know, Lindsay said, you don't see carbon emission. You know, people don't really... can't really relate to it, although maybe a lot of us did relate to it this summer, right, when we saw all our forests burning in Spain, in France, in Italy, in Portugal, in the UK, right? So it's starting the point is starting to hit home, but it's still not as hot, as we'd say, the kitchen hasn't gotten as hot as inflation and cost of living crisis and the cost of fuel and the cost of energy for people to really start making those long-lasting changes.
Yeah, I fully agree. I acknowledge that it seems like a daft question even at this moment, that whether companies would consider that. I think that's, the situation at the moment is what it is, and there's still an awfully long way to go in terms of net zero for our industry. That's it for our news section this week, or our manifesto, in fact, that we've put together over the last half hour or so. Kiese, I just wanted to ask a little bit about how you're seeing
our leader.
Lindsay is absolutely the next prime minister. I will back this. So Kiese, I just wanted to chat a little bit about what you're up to at the moment, your current role at Wunderman Thompson, and the trends you're seeing in the industry at the moment. How's everything going?
How many days do you have? It's been incredibly busy, and I think, you know, any person that you speak to has the same word in their mouth. I've been at Wunderman Thompson for a year, with the mandate to set up and scale our commerce media practice globally. And I genuinely work across four regions. You know, some people have global in their title and then you end up discovering that it's only because they cover UK and France. In my case, it truly is a global role. And I think I never anticipated how global it was going to be. But it's been an interesting journey, you know, working with my colleagues in APAC, working with my colleagues in LATAM, working with my colleagues in the EMEA region and in North America. I've learned a lot. So for us, really, it's about ensuring that we scale our commerce practice, you know, globally, and ensure that, you know, we also really capitalize on the fact that we are a commerce practice first and foremost, right? Even though we're talking about commerce media, even though we're talking about retail media, our heritage still is in commerce. We've been helping clients for many years, you know, with their commerce problems and solutions. And it's about, you know, building on that heritage to just close the gap that existed in some of the regions. In some of the regions, you know, we had commerce practices, flourishing commerce practices, in fact, but in other regions and in certain market locals, we didn't. So that's what I've been busy doing. When I'm doing that, when I'm setting up something in a market, it's from the ground up. So, you know, so some of the pains that some of the retailers are going through right now, to a different extent, we're going through that as well, right? Because we need to build teams, we need to think about who are the tech or media owners partners that we're going to work with. We need to think about how do we structure our proposition. We need to think about our commercial structures, et cetera, et cetera. So all of that has been going on. It's been an interesting journey. I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying sometimes having early morning meetings with APAC and late evening meetings with the North America. But it's been good, busy but good. Good also because what I've discovered within WT is that it's a very collaborative company, right? It's not a space where someone makes it. Oh, you know, like the game of carbon emission that we're talking about earlier on, where everybody thinks it's not my problem. Within WT, what I've encountered is really colleagues that are willing to help, willing to step in. We are in it together. In fact, that is one of our values. And before I joined the company, I was like, yeah, again, one of those flop values we put on the walls that never actually, you know, nobody ever actually leaves. But I've discovered that they actually do leave those values. You know, we really are in it together. People will step in to help you. People will step in to do their part. And that's what I've made this journey even more interesting, right? Because we're busy, I'm busy. But because I have such a huge support network across all four regions, right, it has made it so that that burden is not mine alone to carry. And that has been really eye-opening and very, very refreshing.
Cool. Well, it sounds like...
I don't think I answered your question, actually. Did I answer your question? I don't think I have.
Probably not, no.
Let's just move on.
Even if you didn't, it was a better answer than the question deserved anyway. So thank you very much. It sounds like you've got an incredibly busy time, but glad that it's all going well. And it was really fantastic to have you join us. Thank you so much, Kiese. A real pleasure. And thank you too, Lindsay.
Thank you for having me.
Kiese, one of my favourite guests, probably. Like, that was brilliant. Brilliant conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It was a good laugh.
Good. Well, we hope to see you again soon. So thank you very much again. And thank you all for listening. Take care.